And for Mr. Harper, think where you and I'd be now. He knows that we know his daughter would like to work here, and if we don't make a place for her, he'll think we're awfully unappreciative.
I knew there was a catch in it. I knew it.
What have you got against Doris, Chris?
Oh, I don't like to say anything against any girl, but... Well, I don't like her, Helen. I emphatically don't like her. She's spoiled and selfish and a rotten sport and, well, a few other things.
Oh, she impressed me that day I talked to her as being very sweet.
Well, she's not, I'm sorry to say. In my opinion, she's a, well, a pest.
Have you known her a long time, Chris?
Yes, I used... Well, she runs around with the crowd I used to see a lot of. As a matter of fact, I used to take Doris out a couple of years ago myself, the season she made her debut. She's a spoiled brat, and to tell the truth, I've avoided her for quite a while now.
And she sort of chases after you, is that it?
Well, it would sound conceited if I said yes to that question, but it would be untrue if I said no.
I see. Well, that does complicate things a little. But of course, in time, Doris will catch on that she's wasting her time on you, and she'll give up.
I hope so. Gosh, there's always a fly in the ointment. I've never seen it fail. I thought Doris was kidding coming in here and asking me for a job that day. I never dreamed she really meant it. Oh,
she's serious about designing. Her father told me so.
Doris Harper's not serious about anything but Doris Harper, Helen. There's no reason on earth why she shouldn't work. She lives the life of a social butterfly, and she's got enough money in her own name to buy and sell you and me a half dozen times. I don't want to take her on here, Helen. I don't want to have her around.
Well, what shall we do, Chris? Mr. Harper's been so nice. He told me that it took a great deal of persuading to fix things for me with the other executives at the studio. He went to a great amount of trouble.
I wouldn't be surprised if Doris didn't have a hand in that.
Oh, that's absurd, Chris. Look, don't hold anything against Mr. Harper. He wasn't the least bit pointed about Doris. It's all my idea that we ought to do something in return. I think we're really deeply obligated. Sorry, but we are.
And Doris knows we are, too. I'll bet you that's exactly why she told me she was going to drop in over here this afternoon and see me. Helen, we can't use Doris around here.
Well, we certainly don't need her, but we could make a place for her if we had to.
Well, like what?
Well, for instance, there's always a scarcity of attractive blouses. We could let Doris try her hand at designing some of those.
She'll be a lot better financially and otherwise.
Maybe she won't be financially, Chris. She can do some simple things and perhaps do them more cleverly. I'm not trying to force her on you, but I just can't face Mr. Harper again at the studio unless we give Doris a try.
Yes, I know.
However, if you say no, Chris, then that's that. I don't want to overrule you. If you feel that Doris will annoy you and you can't get along with her here, then at all costs we won't take her on.
Oh, I can get along with her if I have to, I suppose. You're right, Helen. We're stuck with her on account of her old man. Well, go ahead and fix it up with her.
I don't think she'll be here long, Chris. Are you sure you don't mind now?
No. I'm just raising a fuss about, well, making a mountain out of a molehill, I guess. But you do all the talking to Doris, you hear? You employ her. I don't want her to think she's got me to thank. I'll stay out of it.
All right, I'll attend to it entirely. Oh, I'm sorry we have this problem, Chris. I hate for you to have to put up with what it'll mean.
Oh, it's okay, Helen. You can't help it. It's just that almost every favor somebody does you in this world, you have to eventually pay for it. Seems to be a law of nature or something, I guess.
I really feel quite bad about the position it'll put you in, Chris.
Why? I've got nothing against Doris except that I just don't like her kind. She won't bother me around here. I'll just let her catch on that I'm disinterested and busy and I don't care about
her. Oh, Chris, there she is out in front, just coming in the store.
Yeah, where's my hat? I'm going to beat her. I'll look out the side way here. You go ahead and fix it up without me, Helen.
All right.
I'll see you later.
Okay. I hate to have to do this when Chris doesn't like the girl. Guess I better go talk to her if she comes.
How do you do, Mrs. Trent? Remember me, Doris Harper?
Yes, of course, Miss Harper. How do you do?
Fine, thanks. Is Chris around?
Why, he just went out. He had some things to attend to.
Oh, poor Chris. He's always so busy. One of these days he's going to wake up and realize he's busied himself right out of all the fun in life. Oh, this is the loveliest dress on this form here. Did you design it?
Yes, I did.
It's superb. There's genius in this dress. Genius in every line and tuck. Oh, and the way the neck's cut. think you're wonderful, Mrs. Trent.
Thank you. Sit down, Miss Harper, won't you?
Thanks.
I met your father recently at the studio.
Yes, he told me. He came home simply raving to Mother and me about your looks.
Well, I'm very grateful to your father for helping me out of a bad predicament about the shop here. I suppose he told you.
Mm-hmm. Carl's awfully sweet that way. He's always doing things to help people at the studio out of jams.
Well, he told me how seriously interested you are in designing, Miss Harper. I, of course, remember your coming in here before.
Oh, don't feel like you have to bother about me, Mrs. Trent, just on account of Carl. Oh, please don't. That's out of the question.
Oh, it isn't just that. Your father told me how capable you are. And I think it might be well for the shop to have a few things that aren't my work. Maybe some blouses or something?
No, now, really, you mustn't go to any trouble about me. I wouldn't want you to feel, well, you know. Carl wouldn't want you to feel that way either. Now, just forget it.
Don't misunderstand me. I realize that, of course. But as a matter of fact, I do think that the shop might be able to use some of your work if it's satisfactory. And perhaps we could give it a try if you want to. See what you can do.
If I want to? Oh, heavens. If you'd let me, Mrs. Trent, I'd adore it. If you really want me, just because you think I could design things that might actually sell, oh, I'd be thrilled to death.
Well, it all depends on your ability, of course. The designs you've done, and if I think they show sufficient originality, then, well, we'll see about making a place for you here at the shop.
Doris Harper's plan, into which she forced her stepfather, has worked out exactly as she wished it. And now, it seems that Helen is bringing the first note of dissension into the shop. How will Doris and Chris get along? And how will this affect Helen? Well, listen for Helen Trent tomorrow. If you feel that life is growing dull and humdrum of late, it may be simply because you yourself are looking plain, unexciting, the fault of your makeup, your lipstick. Then try the lipstick that many noted French women use to gain the allure for which they're famous. Angelus lipstick. Angelus. The lipstick that has been blended to match the live, vibrant colors of the human blood. Colors that strike an unusual note in makeup and give an allure beyond words. Many smart French women use it on their cheeks as well as their lips to achieve complexion harmony. And a single application will hold for hours. Get an Angelus lipstick today at any drug or department store at the same price as most lipsticks and gain the irresistible allure many French women have. Helen Trent will be on the air at the same time tomorrow. Helen Trent's announcer, Don Hancock.
To keep household mechanical devices running smoothly, use Triple Acting 3-in-1 Oil. Get 3-in-1 at any hardware, grocery, or department store. Also in 10-cent stores and automobile accessory departments. Ask for 3-in-1 oil today.
Once again, we present Our Gal Sunday, the story of an orphan girl named Sunday who was left on the steps of the cabin of two old miners who raised her from childhood in the little mining town of Silver Creek, Colorado. Who, in young womanhood, married England's richest, most handsome lord, Lord Henry Winthrop. The story that asks the question, can this girl from a little mining town in the West find happiness as the wife of a wealthy and titled Englishman? Let me tell you about a remedy that thousands of people now use to get quick relief from the pains caused by headache, neuralgia, and rheumatism. People use it because the results are truly astonishing. This remedy is called Anacin, and the reason so many people rely upon it is that it was first suggested to them by their physician or dentist. Perhaps you, too, at some time, have been handed an envelope containing Anacin tablets. If you haven't discovered Anacin through this channel, then, by all means, discover it for yourself. For your own sake, to get quick relief, Anacin is certainly worth a trial. Of course, there's a reason why Anacin is so amazingly effective. It is made up of a combination of different medically proved and tested ingredients, not just one. It is like a doctor's prescription that way. For a prescription nearly always calls for a combination of different ingredients. Try Anacin on this basis. If the first few tablets fail to give the quick relief you want, you may return the unused portion and your money will be refunded. So, be prepared next time you suffer from a headache or neuralgic and rheumatic pains. Get a supply of Anacin at any drugstore today and have it on hand. Spelled A-N-A-C-I-N, it comes in tins of 12 and 30 or bottles of 50 and 100 tablets. And now, Our Gal Sunday. Much has happened in the last few days at Balmacruci Hospital to prophesy difficult days ahead for Sunday with two members of the staff. First, there is Nurse Rhoda Gray, who because of her jealousy and love of Dr. Alan Brooke has proved particularly objectionable to Sunday. And then there's Alan Brooke himself, whose personal interest in Sunday is becoming a major problem to her. However, these problems have been in some part counteracted. Although Sunday is facing her first long separation from Lord Henry, who is now a captain in the English army, she's been comforted, not only by his letters, but by a feeling and knowledge that there are times when their love brings them together in an unusual and beautiful manner, keeping both of them from feeling that distance can separate them. Sunday is now in the living room of the lodge, sitting with Lord Percy before a crackling fire. Listen.
Fire feels good these misty Scotch days, doesn't it, Uncle Percy?
Yes, it does, Sunday.
If you've been down to the village this morning, you must be tired.
Tired? Of course I'm not tired. Don't pamper me, Sunday.
I'm not pampering you, Uncle Percy. I was going to suggest that you stay here with me for a while. I don't have to go to the hospital until later on.
Do I look as if I'm leaving?
No, you don't. You look comfortable.
Comfortable? That's it. I'm too comfortable. Details. Details of turning Balmacruci Castle into a hospital. Is that a man's work? No.
What are you talking about?
Morning, noon, and night I fuss about with lists, with orders. Try to give the hospital staff advice. They don't want it. They know better than I do how to equip a hospital. What do they think I am, a useless old man, eh?
Well, of course not, Uncle Percy. You aren't old, and you're certainly not useless.
Well, if I'm not useless, why am I not in the army? Answer me that.
Why, because, well, there's no need for you to be, Uncle Percy. And you served in the last war.
Nonsense. There's no reason for me to be up here in Scotland, sitting before a fire, warming my toes, or to be in London. Anywhere but here.
But, Uncle Percy, you offered Balmacruci Castle to the government to be used as a hospital. That was a wonderful thing.
But why did they tell me to stay here and look after it? It's a conspiracy, that's what it is.
Uncle Percy, you're needed at Balmacruci. That's why you were asked to stay here. Uncle Percy, you know, I've been thinking of something the last few days.
What?
The attitude of the people everywhere, all over England. No matter how they're feeling inside, they're taking all their troubles, all their problems cheerfully.
Mm, I noticed that too, Sunday.
It's inspiring. That's the way life should be. Full of courage and hope and doing the job at hand.
Now look here, my dear. Are you trying to tell me in a roundabout, feminine sort of fashion that I shouldn't be complaining about doing work that a fair to middling bookkeeper could do?
Uncle Percy, of course I'm not.
Hope not.
After all, your work is more exacting than that. There's no sense in pretending that it isn't important because you know it is. But didn't you check the plans of all the rebuilding necessary in the castle? Didn't you get a letter from Sir Robert Winslow, chairman of the hospital board, congratulating you on suggestions you made?
Yes, I did. Yes, by Jove, I did.
And this morning when you went to the village, wasn't it to personally supervise orders for food supplies for the hospital?
Yes.
And you say you aren't doing enough. Uncle Percy, I'm ashamed of you.
Oh, Sunday, you're a nuisance. You won't even let a man complain in peace. Oh, bless my stupid brain. I forgot. Got a letter for you. Brought it from the village to save the boy bicycle ride out.
A letter for me?
Yes. Where did I put it? Must be in my inside coat pocket.
Uncle Percy, is it from Henry?
No, it isn't, Sandy. Oh, here it is. And see for yourself.
Oh, thank you. No, it isn't Henry's writing. Uncle Percy, it's from Arthur. From Henry's brother, Arthur.
It is it? What's he doing writing to you?
Well, I wanted him to write, Uncle Percy. He came to see us before Henry left England. He was in his uniform, waiting for orders. He promised Henry to turn over a new leaf.
Well, read it, my dear, read it. What does he have to say?
Well, let's see. Dear Sunday, don't be surprised at my writing you. You said I might, you know. And you're the only one of the family at home I can write to. Uncle Percy would...
What's that?
Uncle Percy would probably growl himself into a minor fit if he even saw my handwriting.
Blasted impertinence. Me growl myself into a fit? What does he mean?
Though he might be secretly pleased, because I know jolly well he cares for every one of us very deeply. Even me, the black sheep of the Brintook family.
I have to write to Arthur myself and ask him what he means. Discussing me in a letter to you.
It's a long letter. Something to tell you.
What is it?
Wait, what's this? Something about Thomas McTaggart. Uncle Percy, Kathy's husband. But that means he may have seen Henry, because Thomas is Henry's orderly. Let me see. Uncle Percy, yes, there is something about him.
Well, read it, my dear, read it.
Where did it begin? Oh, here. And so then I went to the company canteen. I was outside the door.
Yes?
I heard voices inside. A voice I vaguely recognized.
And the captain says to me, he says, Thomas McTaggart, I'm glad to see you, man. And how would you like to be more orderly? And so I looked the captain in the eye, and I says to him, attention. Second lieutenant.
Carry on, men. The captain's orderly here?
Yeah, that would be me, sir. Private McTaggart speaking.
Private McTaggart? Thomas?
Well, sir, I don't know how you...
What? Lieutenant Arthur Brinthrope. I can't believe my eyes, sir.
Thomas, it's good to see you again.
Aye, well, it's the first time in over 3 years.
Yes, it's all of that, Thomas. Is your captain about?
Oh, aye, sir, that he is. In his office at this very minute, working on his reports. If you'll come with me.
Oh, wait a second, Thomas. There's something I want to ask you about. Let's stand on this hall, shall we?
Aye, Lieutenant. Yes, sir. What did you want to say to me, sir?
See here, Thomas. I heard in a roundabout way that your second lieutenant is being transferred. Know anything about it?
Aye, that's the truth, sir. And I'm wishing this very instant that you were taking his place. Ah, 'tis a great company, sir, and it's a great captain we've got. Are you thinking of joining us?
Well, yes, I am.
Oh, that's good. I mean, captain...
Not so fast. I'm my own way of doing this, you know.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I was only thinking that when captain...
Yes, I know. Your captain will have to approve of me first.
Oh, but he will, sir, he will. How can he help it when...
Where's the captain's room, Thomas?
Oh, well, I'll take you there.
No, thanks, I'll find it. Down hall of fifth, isn't it?
It's the third room on the right, Lieutenant.
Now I'll find it. Cheerio, Thomas.
Cheerio, sir.
No name on the door. Well, here goes. I'll try this one.
Come in.
Captain, I'm a lieutenant from the...
Arthur.
Henry. Why, Henry.
By Jove, Arthur, this is a surprise.
Yes. Yes, it is.
But...
I talked with Thomas, and I told him I wanted to see the captain. I had no idea you were captain. Oh, I say, Henry...
Well, sit down, Arthur. Well, I didn't know you'd come from home.
Henry, is it true your second lieutenant is being transferred?
Oh, yes. Is that why you're here, Arthur?
Yes. I'd like to take his place. There are some friends of mine in this company, and now that I know that you're...
But, Arthur, what does your commanding officer say?
If you approve... He'll recommend me for a transfer.
But Arthur, I don't know. You see...
Oh, please, Henry. Please, do this for me.
But Arthur, I'll have to think it over.
Oh, come now, Henry. You can do it. It all depends on you.
Yes, I realize that.
I worked like the dickens to get my commission. Now I want a chance to prove myself worthy of it.
To prove yourself worthy of it, of course, yes.
Now, see here, Henry. I made you a promise before we left England. I promised never to cause you any trouble again. And you said we could be friends.
Yes. And I know, Arthur, I know. I am your friend. And I'm your brother, Arthur. You see, that's the point. I want to do what's best for you. It isn't that I don't trust you, but I can show no favors, not a hair's breadth. Now, without meaning to, there might come a time when you'd expect that hair's breadth of favor.
Oh, I swear to you,
Harry. Let's not risk that. What do you say? You stick by your own company and you'll get your promotions. You know, human nature is a strange thing. We're brothers. A great deal of the misunderstanding between us has been because I'm the older. But we have that same situation here. The time may come when you would resent taking orders from me, orders that, well, you'd accept willingly from someone else.
Oh, but at home, you offered me another chance. It will mean a lot to me, Henry.
Arthur, I... Very well, Arthur.
Oh, Job, Henry, I'm awfully
glad. I'll be glad to have you in my company, Arthur. But I want you to know that once you're part of it, officially, I can consider you no longer my brother. If there's a job to be done, regardless of what it is, and I have to choose a man from my men, and you're the one chosen, I expect courage from you, the best you have to give. I expect it from you as much as I do from myself. Well, with this understood, I'll recommend your transfer to this company.
What will happen to these two brothers fighting side by side? One, a captain, the other, a subordinate. Will Henry be placed in a difficult position? Will Arthur's past misdeeds play any part? And what of Sunday's own situation at Balmacucci Hospital and Nurse Rhoda Gray's jealousy because of Dr. Alan Brooks' infatuation for Sunday? What dramatic twist will the personal problem surrounding Sunday take next? Be sure to listen tomorrow to the next episode of Our Gal Sunday. Our Gal Sunday is brought to you by the makers of Anacin, that remarkable way to get quick relief from the pains of headache, neuralgia, or neuritis. The reason Anacin acts so fast is because it is like a doctor's prescription, a combination of medically tested active ingredients. Next time you have a headache or neuralgic pain, try Anacin. You'll be amazed at what it does for you. All drugstores have Anacin in tins of 12 and 30 or bottles of 50 and 100 tablets. Anacin is spelled A-N-A-C-I-N. Our Gal Sunday will be on the air at the same time tomorrow, 12:45 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Your announcer, James Fleming. Why cook two sets of meals, one for baby, one for the family? Get Klapp's strained baby foods. Klapp's foods are already prepared, pressure cooked to safeguard vitamins and minerals, smoothly strained but never too liquid. Many doctors approve Klapp's strained baby foods. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Prisons. A Social Crime and Failure. In 1849, Dostoevsky wrote on the wall of his prison cell the following story of the priest and the devil. Quote, "Hello, you little fat father," the devil said to the priest. "What made you lie so to these poor misled people? What tortures of hell did you depict? Don't you know that they already suffer the tortures of hell in their earthly lives? Don't you know that you and the authorities of the state are my representatives on earth? It is you that make them suffer the pains of hell with which you threaten them. Don't you know this? Well, then, come with me." The devil grabbed the priest by the collar, lifted him high in the air, and carried him to a factory, to an iron foundry. He saw the workmen there running, hurrying to and fro, and toiling in the scorching heat. Very soon the thick, heavy air and the heat are too much for the priest. With tears in his eyes, he pleads with the devil, "Let me go! Let me leave this hell!" "Oh, my dear friend, I must show you many more places." The devil gets hold of him again and drags him off to a farm. There he sees workmen thrashing the grain. The dust and heat are insufferable. The overseer carries a knout and unmercifully beats anyone who falls to the ground, overcome by hard toil or hunger. Next, the priest is taken to the huts where these same workers live with their families. Dirty, cold, smoky, ill-smelling holes. The devil grins. He points out the poverty and hardship which are at home here. "Well, isn't this enough?" he asks. and it seems as if even he, the devil, pities the people. The pious servant of God can hardly bear it. With uplifted hands, he begs, "Let me go away from here. Yes, yes, this is hell on earth." "Well, you see, then." And you still promise them another hell. You torment them, torture them to death mentally when they are already all but dead physically. "Come on, I will show you one more hell. One more, the very worst." He took him to a prison and showed him a dungeon, with its foul air and the many human forms, robbed of all health and energy, lying on the floor, covered with vermin that were devouring their poor, naked, emaciated bodies. "Take off your silken clothes," said the devil to the priest. "Put on your ankle chains, such that these unfortunates wear. Lie down on the cold and filthy floor, and then talk to them about a hell that still awaits them." "No, no," answered the priest. "I cannot think of anything more dreadful than this. I entreat you, let me go away from here." "Yes, this is hell. There can be no worse hell than this. Did you not know it? Did you not know that these men and women who you are frightening with the picture of a hell hereafter, did you not know that they are already in hell right here before they die?" End quote. This was written 50 years ago in dark Russia, on the wall of one of the most horrible prisons. Yet who can deny that the same applies with equal force to the present time, even to American prisons? With all our boasted reforms, our great social changes, and our far-reaching discoveries, human beings continue to be sent to the worst of hells, wherein they are outraged, degraded, and tortured, that society may be, quote, protected from the phantoms of its own making. Prison? A social protection? What monstrous mind ever conceived of such an idea? Just as well say that health can be promoted by a widespread contagion. After 18 months of horror in an English prison, Oscar Wilde gave to the world his great masterpiece, The Ballad of Reading Gaol. The vilest deeds, like poison weeds, bloom well in prison air. It is only what is good in man that wastes and withers there. Pale anguish keeps the heavy gate, and the warder is despair. Society goes on perpetuating this poison air, not realizing that out of it can come naught but the most poisonous results. We are spending at the present $3,500,000 per day, $1,095,000 per year to maintain prison institutions, and that in a democratic country, a sum almost as large as the combined output of wheat valued at $750,000 and the output of coal valued at $350,000. Professor Bushnell of Washington, D.C. estimates the cost of prisons at $6 million annually, and Dr. G. Frank Lidston, an eminent American writer on crime, gives us $5 million annually as a reasonable figure. Such unheard-of expenditure for the purpose of maintaining vast armies of human beings caged up like wild beasts. Yet crimes are on the increase. Thus we learn that in America there are 4.5 times as many crimes to every million population today as there were 20 years ago. The most horrible aspect is that our national crime is murder, not robbery, embezzlement, or rape, as in the South. London is 5 times as large as Chicago, yet there are 118 murders annually in the latter city, while only 20 in London. Nor is Chicago the leading city in crime, since it is only 7th on the list, which is headed by 4 southern cities and San Francisco and Los Angeles. In view of such a terrible condition of affairs, it seems ridiculous to prate of the protection society derives from its prisons. The average mind is slow in grasping a truth, but when the most thoroughly organized, centralized institution, maintained at an excessive national expense, has proven a complete social failure, the dullest must begin to question its right to exist. The time is past when we can be content with our social fabric merely because it is, quote, ordained by divine right, or by the majesty of the law. The widespread prison investigations, agitation, and education during the last few years are conclusive proof that men are learning to dig deep into the very bottom of society, down to the causes of the terrible discrepancy between social and individual life. Why, then, are prisons a social crime and a failure? To answer this vital question, it behooves us to seek the nature and cause of crimes, the methods employed in coping with them, and the effects these methods produce in ridding society of the curse and horror of crimes. First, as to the nature of crime. Havelock Ellis divides crime into 4 phases: the political, the passional, the insane, and the occasional. He says that the political criminal is the victim of an attempt of a more or less despotic government to preserve its own stability. He is not necessarily guilty of an unsocial offense. He simply tries to overturn a certain political order which may itself be antisocial. This truth is recognized all over the world, except in America, where the foolish notion still prevails that in a democracy there is no place for political criminals. Yet John Brown was a political criminal. So were the Chicago anarchists. So was every striker. Consequently, says Havelock Ellis, the political criminal of our time or place may be the hero, the martyr, saint of another age. Lombroso calls the political criminal the true precursor of the progressive movement of humanity. Quote, the criminal by passion is usually a man of wholesome birth and honest life, who under the stress of some great unmerited wrong has wrought justice for himself, end quote. Mr. Hugh C. Weir, in The Menace of the Police, cites the case of Jim Flaherty, a criminal by passion, who instead of being saved by society is turned into a drunkard and a recidivist, with a ruined and poverty-stricken family as the result. A more pathetic type is Archie, the victim in Bram Wilcox's novel The Turn of the Balance, the greatest American expose of crime in the making. Archie, even more than Flaherty, was driven to crime and death by the cruel inhumanity of his surroundings and by the unscrupulous hounding of the machinery of the law. Archie and Flaherty are but the types of many thousands, demonstrating how the legal aspects of crime and the methods of dealing with it help to create the disease which is undermining our entire social life. Quote, the insane criminal really can no more be considered a criminal than a child, since he is mentally in the same condition as an infant or an animal, end quote. The law already recognizes that, but only in rare cases of a very flagrant nature, or when the culprit's wealth permits the luxury of criminal insanity. It has become quite fashionable to be the victim of paranoia. But on the whole, the quote, sovereignty of justice still continues to punish criminally insane with the whole severity of its power. Thus, Mr. Ellis quotes from Dr. Richter's statistics showing that in Germany, 106 madmen out of 144 criminally insane were condemned to severe punishment. The occasional criminal, quote, represents by far the largest class of our prison population, hence it is the greatest menace to social well-being, end quote. What is the cause that compels a vast army of the human family to take to crime, to prefer the hideous life within prison walls to the life outside? Certainly that cause must be an iron master, who leaves its victims no avenue of escape, for the most depraved human being loves liberty. This terrific force is conditioned in our cruel social and economic arrangement. I do not mean to deny the biologic, physiologic, or psychologic factors in creating crime, but there is hardly an advanced criminologist who will not concede that the social and economic influences are the most relentless, the most poisonous germs of crime. Granted even that there are an innate criminal tendency, it is nonetheless true that these tendencies find rich nutrition in our social environment. There is close relation, says Havelock Ellis, between crimes against the person and the price of alcohol, between crimes against property and the price of wheat. He quotes Quetelet and Lassagard, the former looking upon society as a preparer of crime, and the criminals as instruments that execute them. The latter finds that, quote, the social environment is the cultivation medium of criminality, that the criminal is the microbe, an element which only becomes important when it finds the medium which causes it to ferment. Every society has the criminals it deserves, end quote. The most, quote, prosperous industrial period makes it impossible for the worker to earn enough to keep up health and vigor. And as prosperity is, at best, an imaginary condition, thousands of people are constantly added to the host of the unemployed. From east to west, from north to south, this vast army of tramps in search for work and food, and all they find is the workhouse or the slums. Those who have a spark of self-respect left prefer open defiance, prefer crime to the emaciated, degraded position of poverty. Edward Carpenter estimates that 5/6 of indictable crimes consist of some violation of property rights, but that is too low a figure. A thorough investigation would prove that 9 crimes out of 10 could be traced, directly or indirectly, to our economic and social inequalities, to our system of remorseless exploitation and robbery. There is no criminal so stupid but recognizes this terrible fact, though he may not be able to account for it. A collection of criminal philosophy, which Havelock Ellis, Lombroso, and other eminent men have compiled, shows that the criminal feels only too keenly that it is society that drives him to crime. A Milanese thief said to Lombroso, quote, I do not rob. I merely take from the rich their superfluities. Besides, do not advocates and merchants rob? End quote. A murderer wrote, quote, knowing that 3/4 of the social virtues are cowardly vices, I thought an open assault on a rich man would be less ignoble than the cautious combination of fraud. End quote. Another wrote, quote, I am in prison for stealing a 6 eggs. Ministers who rob millions are honored. Poor Italy. End quote. An educated convict said to Mr. David, quote, the laws of society are framed for the purpose of securing the wealth of the world to power and calculation. thereby depriving the larger portion of mankind of its rights and chances. Why should they punish me for taking by somewhat similar means from those who have taken more than they had any right to? End quote. The same man added, quote, religion robs the soul of its independence. Patriotism is the stupid worship of the world for which the well-being and the peace of the inhabitants were sacrificed by those who profit from it, while the laws of the land in restraining natural desires were waging war on the manifest spirit of the law of our beings. Compared with this, he concluded, thieving is an honorable pursuit. End quote. Verily, there is greater truth in this philosophy than in all the law and moral books of society. The economic, political, moral, and physical factors being the microbes of crime, how does society meet the situation? The methods of coping with crime have no doubt undergone several changes, but mainly in the theoretic sense. In practice, society has retained the primitive motive in dealing with the offender, that is, revenge. It has also adopted the theologic idea, namely, punishment, while the legal and civilized methods consist of deterrence or terror and reform. We shall presently see that all four modes have failed utterly, and that we are today no nearer a solution than in the Dark Ages. The natural impulse of the primitive men to strike back, to avenge a wrong, is out of date. Instead, the civilized man, stripped of courage and daring, has delegated to an organized machinery the duty of avenging his wrongs, in the foolish belief that the state is justified in doing what he no longer has the manhood or consistency to do. The, quote, majesty of the law, end quote, is a reasoning thing. It would not stoop to primitive instincts. Its mission is of a higher nature. True, it is still steeped in the theologic muddle, which proclaims punishment as a means of purification, or the vicarious atonement of sin. But legally and socially, the statute exercises punishment, not merely as an infliction of pain upon the offender, but also for its terrifying effect upon others. What is the real basis of punishment, however? The notion of a free will, the idea that man is at all times a free agent for good or evil. If he chooses the latter, he must be made to pay the price. Although this theory has long been exploded and thrown upon the dust heap, it continues to be applied daily by the entire machinery of government, turning it into the most cruel and brutal tormentor of human life. The only reason for its continuance is the still more cruel notion that the greater the terror punishment spreads, the more certain its preventative effect. Society is using the most drastic methods in dealing with the social offender. Why do they not deter? Although in America a man is supposed to be considered innocent until proven guilty, the instruments of law, the police, carry on a reign of terror, making the indiscriminate arrests, beating, clubbing, bullying people, using the barbarous method of the third degree, subjecting their unfortunate victims to the foul air of the station house and the still fouler language of its guardians. Yet crimes are rapidly multiplying and society is paying the price. On the other hand, it is an open secret that when the unfortunate citizen has been given the full mercy of the law and for the sake of safety is hidden in the worst of hells, his real cavalry begins. Robbed of his rights as a human being, degraded to a mere automaton, without will or feeling, dependent entirely upon the mercy of brutal keepers, he daily goes through a process of dehumanization, compared with which savage revenge was mere child's play. There is not a single penal institution or reformatory in the United States where men are not tortured, quote, to be made good, end quote, by means of the blackjack, the club, the straitjacket, the water cure, the, quote, hummingbird, end quote, an electrical contrivance run along the human body, the solitary, the bullring, the starvation diet. In these institutions, his will is broken, his soul is degraded, his spirit subdued by the deadly monotony and routine of prison life. In Ohio, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and in the South, these horrors have become so flagrant as to reach the outside world, while in most other prisons, the same Christian methods still prevail. But prison walls rarely allow the agonized shrieks of the victims to escape. Prison walls are thick, they dull the sound. Society might, with greater immunity, abolish all prisons at once than to hope for protection from these 20th century chambers of horror. Year after year, the gates of prison hells return to the world an emaciated, deformed, will-less, shipwrecked crew of humanity, with the cane mark on their foreheads, their hopes crushed, all their natural inclinations thwarted. With nothing but hunger and inhumanity to greet him, these victims soon sink back into crime as the only possibility of existence. It is not at all an unusual thing to find men and women who have spent half their lives, nay, almost their entire existence, in prison. I know a woman on Blackwell's Island who had been in and out 38 times. and through a friend I learned that a young boy of 17, whom he had nursed and cared for in the Pittsburgh penitentiary, had never known the meaning of liberty. From the reformatory to the penitentiary had been the path of this boy's life, until, broken in body, he died a victim of social revenge. These personal experiences are substantiated by extensive data, giving overwhelming proof of the utter futility of prisons as a means of deterrence or reform. Well-meaning persons are now working for a new departure in the prison question, reclamation, to restore once more to the prisoner the possibility of becoming a human being. Commendable as this is, I fear it is impossible to hope for good results from pouring good wine into a musty bottle. Nothing short of a complete reconstruction of society will deliver mankind from the cancer of crime. Still, if the dull edge of our social conscience would be sharpened, the penal institutions might be given a new coat of varnish. But the first step to be taken is the renovation of the social consciousness, which is in a rather dilapidated condition. It is sadly in need to be awakened to the fact that crime is a question of degree, that we all have the rudiments of crime in us, more or less, according to our mental, physical, and social environment, and that the individual criminal is merely a reflex of the tendencies of the aggregate. With the social consciousness wakened, the average individual may learn to refuse the honor of being the bloodhound of the law. He may cease to persecute, despise, and mistrust the social offender, and give him a chance to live and breathe among his fellows. Institutions are, of course, harder to reach. They are cold, impenetrable, and cruel. Still, with a social consciousness quickened, it may be possible to free the prison victims from the brutality of prison officials, guards, and keepers. Public opinion is a powerful weapon. Keepers of human prey, even, are afraid of it. They may be taught a little humanity, especially if they realize that their jobs depend on it. But the most important step is to demand for the prisoner the right to work while in prison, with some monetary recompense that would enable him to lay aside a little for the day of his release, the beginning of a new life. It is almost ridiculous to hope much from present society when we consider that working men, wage slaves themselves, object to convict labor. I shall not go into the cruelty of this objection, but merely consider the impracticability of it. To begin with, the opposition so far raised by organized labor has been directed against windmills. Prisoners have always worked. Only the state has been their exploiter, even as the individual employer has been the robber of organized labor. The states have either set the convicts to work for the government, or they have farmed convict labor to private individuals. 29 of the states pursued the latter plan. The federal government and 17 states have discarded it, as have the leading nations of Europe, since it leads to hideous overworking and abuse of prisoners, and to endless graft. Quote, Rhode Island, the state dominated by Aldrich, offers perhaps the worst example. Under a 5-year contract dated July 7, 1906, and renewable for 5 years more at the option of private contractors, the labor of the inmates of the Rhode Island Penitentiary and the Province County Jail is sold to the Rawlins Stirring Manufacturing Company at the rate of a trifle less than 25 cents a day per man. This company is really a gigantic prison labor trust, for it also leases the convict labor of Connecticut, Michigan, Indiana, Nebraska, and South Dakota penitentiaries, and the reformatories of New Jersey, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin, 11 establishments in all. The enormity of the graft under the Rhode Island contract may be estimated from the fact that this same company pays 62.5 cents a day in Nebraska for the convict's labor, and that in Tennessee, for example, gets $1.10 a day for convict's work from the Gray Dudley Hardware Company. Missouri gets 70 cents a day from the Star Overall Manufacturing Company. West Virginia gets 65 cents a day from the Kraft Manufacturing Company, and Maryland 55 cents a day from Oppenheimer shirt manufacturers. The very differences in price points to enormous graft. For example, the Reliance Sterling Manufacturing Company manufactures shirts, the cost by free labor being not less than $1.20 per person, while it pays Rhode Island 30 cents a dozen. Furthermore, the state charges this trust no rent for the use of its huge factories, charging nothing for power, heat, light, or even drainage, and exacts no taxes. What graft? End quote. It is estimated that more than $12 million worth of working men's shirts and overalls is produced annually in this country by prison labor. It is a woman's industry, and the first reflection that arises is that an immense amount of free female labor is thus displaced. The second consideration is that male convicts, who should be learning trades that would give them some chance of being self-supporting after their release, are kept at this work at which they cannot possibly make a dollar. This is the more serious when we consider that much of this labor is done in reformatories, which so loudly profess to be training their inmates to become useful citizens. The third and most important consideration is that the enormous profit thus wrung from the convict labor are a constant incentive to the contractors to exact from their unhappy victims tasks altogether beyond their strength, and to punish them cruelly when their work does not come up to the excessive demands made. Another word on the condemnation of convicts to tasks at which they cannot hope to make a living after release. Indiana, for example, is a state that has made a great splurge over being in the front rank of modern penological improvements. Yet, according to the report rendered in 1908 by the training school of its, quote, reformatory, 135 engaged in the manufacture of chains, 207 in that of shirts, and 255 in the foundry, a total of 597 in three occupations. But at the so-called reformatory, 59 occupations were represented by the inmates, 39 of which were connected with county pursuits. Indiana, like other states, professes to be training the inmates of her reformatory to occupations which they will be able to make their living when released. She actually sets them to work making chains, shirts, and brooms, the latter for the benefit of Louisville Fancy Grocery Company. Broom making is a trade largely monopolized by the blind, shirt making is done by women, and there is only one free chain factory in the state, and at that a released convict cannot hope to get employed. The whole thing is a cruel farce. If, then, the states can be instrumental in robbing their helpless victims of such tremendous profits, is it not high time for organized labor to stop its idle howl and to insist on decent remuneration for the convict, even as labor organizations claim for themselves? In that way, working men will kill the germ which makes of the prisoners an enemy to the interests of labor. We have said elsewhere that thousands of convicts, incompetent and without trade, without means of subsistence, are yearly turned back into the social fold. These men and women must live, for even an ex-convict has needs. Prison life has made them antisocial beings, and the rigidity of closed doors that meet them on their release are not likely to decrease their bitterness. The inevitable result is that they form a favorable nucleus out of which scabs, blacklegs, detectives, and policemen are drawn, only too willing to do their master's bidding. Thus organized labor, by its foolish opposition to prison work, defeats its own ends. It helps to create poisonous fumes that stifle every attempt for economic betterment. If the working man wants to avoid these effects, he should insist on the right of the convict to work. He should meet him as his brother, take him into his organization, and with his aid, turn against the system which grinds them both. Last, but not least, is the growing realization of the barbarity and the inadequacy of the definite sentence. Those who believe in and earnestly aim at a change are fast coming to the conclusion that man must be given an opportunity to make good. And how is he to do it with 10, 15, or 20 years imprisonment before him? The hope of liberty and of opportunity is the only incentive to life, especially the prisoner's life. Society has sinned so long against him, it ought to at least leave him that. I am not very sanguine that it will, or that any real change in that direction can take place until the conditions that breed both the prisoner and the jailer will be forever abolished.
Goedemorgen.
Oh, wat de bank. Gut, wat leuk zeg, dat ik u nu al eens aan de telefoon heb. Bedankt nog die loketjevrouw, die altijd zo charmant doet tegen de heren en zo kil tegen de dames. Nee, en u zegt daar niet eens van bewust. God zeg, nou, maar dan moet u daar toch eens op letten hoor. Maar wat kan ik voor u wezen dan? Ik heb een wat afgegeven, zegt u? Een ongedekte cheque. Jezus. Wilt u wel geloven dat er nou opeens een hele nieuwe wereld voor me opengaat? Nee, maar een ongedekte cheque, zeg. Daar heb ik nou nog nooit aan gedacht, hè. Dat er natuurlijk mannetjescheques en vrouwtjescheques zijn. Net als bij de bijtjes en de blommetjes. Oh jee, dat is er ik wat dom eigenlijk van me, hè. Dat ik daar nooit bij heb stilgestaan. Nooit. Nooit dus afgevraagd waar dan toch het kleine geld vandaan komt, zeg. Maar ik moet me wel even gaan schamen, niet? Dat ik daar nou in mijn kinderlijke onbedorvenheid een ongedekte cheque sta af te geven. Wat zult u gelachen hebben, ja? Hallo! Hallo! Heeft u neergelegd misschien? Fijn, dank u. Zo, weer een dag dichter bij het eind van de maand.
Morgenleen.
Hi, Koen. Zeg, ben jij nog zo vroeg of is meneer Buur zo laat?
Hè? Ja, om met de chef te spreken. Goeie vraag, Lien. Ik hoorde het hem nog zeggen.
Wat zeg je nou?
Ik hoorde het hem nog zeggen, Lien. Zoals hij dat zeggen kon, hè.
Koen, joh. Is er iets gebeurd?
Iets gebeurd. wel. Nee, zeg, hoe kom je daar nou bij zo tegen? Nee, wat zou er gebeurd moeten zijn, niet? Wel, nee, niks aan de hand, hoor. Maak je niet, ongerust.
Nee, ik dacht even dat er met meneer Biels iets rampzaligs gebeurd was, hè?
Nee.
Nee? Nou, je hebt me gelukkig weer helemaal gerustgesteld.
Ja, fijn zo. Leen.
Ja, joh, zeg het eens.
Leen, er is met de chef iets rampzaligs gebeurd, Leen.
Tjoh, wat vertel je me nou toch? Wat heeft hij?
Hij is... Ja, dit is alles wat ik erover zeggen kan, meid. Mag ik het hier wel laten?
Ja, zeker. Nee, zeg maar niks meer, hoor. Voor je het weet, flap je eruit.
Dat bedoel ik.
Je zou het jezelf je leven lang kwalijk nemen.
Het idee.
Arme jij.
Nee, onzin, Lien. Geen meelij met mij, alstublieft. Dan staat de chef er heel wat slechter voor, zeg.
Ja? Wat is er met hem aan de hand, eigenlijk?
Die is ontvoerd.
Nee.
Jazeker, die heb... Nee.
Ach, jeetje, nou... Was dat wat je niet zeggen mocht?
Lien, luister, Lien, ik stel het heel scherp nou, ja. De chef is ontvoerd, akkoord. Dat weet je dan, maar meer dan ook niet, Lien. In 's mans eigen voordeel. Vraag niet verder. Vraag niet waarom, waar en door wie. Chef is ontvoerd. Allah, mondje dit, open en uit.
Zo, op mij kun je rekenen, hoor. Dat weet je toch?
Tuurlijk, weet ik dat.
Maar wat verschrikkelijk, hè?
Een ramp.
En wat zegt de politie?
De politie, Lien, klaar en duidelijk, dit, Lien. Als de politie er ook maar de lucht van krijgt, is het... Met de chef.
Nee.
Nee? Meid, ik heb het op het hond toch een keer gehad. Lien, je zou niet verder vragen, Lien.
Oh, jezus, wat vervelend nou, hè? Ik flap er ook maar alles uit, hè?
Nou, de grote uitflap ben ik anders, zeg. Die knapen moeten mij nodig als een vertrouwensman nemen met mijn rafel altijd. Verbindingsman met de pers, notabene.
Hé, kom nou, joh. Bij mij is het veilig, hoor.
Weet ik wel, Lien. Maar tegenover die knapen, hè, die dan nog altijd tegen me opkijken. Tegen hun koemeloen.
Ja, wat een verschrikkelijk mal idee eigenlijk, zeg. Dat jij de hand hebt in de ontvoering van meneer Biel.
Lien, wat moet ik, Lien? Van mij willen ze nog wel eens wat aannemen, ja. Als ik niet had gesteld van. En jullie vragen een losprijs en geen fancyprijs voor die man. Dan was de chef nou al...
Ja... En waar zit hij nou dan, zeg?
Thuis, chef zit thuis.
Thuis? En je zei dat hij ontvoerd was.
Hé, ja, de technieken, ja, die knapen overlaten, die kennen de hele toepermaro-literatuur uit hun hoofd. Wat is de laatste plaats waar je een ontvoerd mens zoekt? Thuis, in zijn eigen logeerkamer.
Oh, ja, zeg. Maar zijn vrouw?
Tja, hoe ze hem dat flikken? Dat vroeg ik neef even nog. Hij zegt, hoi, vogel.
Hi, Eef.
Kijk nou even, is oma Auk te laat?
Wat zeg je nou, jullie hebben de chef toch?
Oh jeetje, de stumper.
Knaap, joh, jullie hebben toch geen stommiteiten met de chef uitgehaald?
Ja, nee, sorry, Koen. Oh jeetje, kraak.
Heilige strozak, knaap, dat gaat je honkse gemeentesubsidie kosten. Sta je daar wel eens bij stil?
Ja, nee, kijk, moet je horen, Koen, wij moesten gisteren nog even ergens tegen demonstreren, weet je wel?
Ja, maar de chef, wat daarmee?
Ja, die hebben we nou helemaal vergeten, Koen. Dus vrees maar gerust het ergste, hoor jij.
Ja, wat hamer, kerel. Dus die man die zit daar volkomen geïsoleerd in zijn logeerkamer.
Ja, die zal daar zitten mompelen. Dan gaat hij altijd zitten mompelen als hij in zijn eentje zit. Dan mompelt hij zo van...
Dat ongebroken, hè. Dat geen angst kennen. Dat persoonlijke moed hebben. Dat hebben wij. Wij Biels, goeiemorgen.
Morgen, meneer Biels.
Morgen.
Chef. U hier, chef.
Ja, zoals je ziet, Paul. Ik ben maar eens voor de aardigheid ontvlucht.
Ha, ha, ha. Ja, spuil.
Pardon?
Jee, wat is dat, spuil,
ja, handig, hè, gisteren, vies uitgerekend. Dat schoot me opeens te binnen zijn, dat scheelt me een bom geld, wegwezen, vluchten. En de tweede poging al raak, zeg.
Ja, nee, oma ouder is tegen de afspraken, zeg.
Ja, hebben jullie je dan aan je afspraken gehouden?
Jazeker wel.
Jazeker, helemaal niet. Bo?
Chef, één ding, chef. Ik weet niet om welke afspraken het gaat. En wat hun politieke acties betreft, heiligt bij die knapen het doel de middelen. Maar hun afspraken zijn hun heilig, zeg.
Ja, ter helle de heren, hun afspraken zijn hun heilig, hoor je. Maar als ik als conditie een redelijk onderkomen en goed voedsel stel, wat krijg ik dan? Een donker hol met hondenvoer, meneer Pol.
Ja, chef, sorry, maar bij een politieke ontvoering is het niet de gewoonte dat het slachtoffer condities zal stellen, chef.
Nee, bij een politieke ontvoering misschien niet, Pol. Maar bij een commerciële, nou degelijk man, daar betaal ik voor.
Chef, bedoelt u?
Ja, je denkt toch niet dat een Biels zich om politieke redenen laat ontvoeren, wel? Wij lenen ons niet voor clownerie, meneer Pol.
Dat is mogelijk, ja. Chef. Maar mag ik dan misschien wel weten waarom ik dan opeens overal buiten moet worden gehouden, chef?
Oh, de eenvoudige reden dat jij je mond nog alles voorbij pleegt te praten, Paul.
Uw punt, chef.
Juist.
Zeg maar, wat dient die hele komedie dan voor?
Ja, voor Bruin, de helft. Voor Bakkie, Bruin Waspik, chauffeur Bakkie Bruin Waspik van het Nieuwe Heden.
De krant?
Ja, de krant, ja. Gaat uitbreiden namelijk, Bakkie, nieuw redactiegebouw. Bouwt hij van de regering steun aan de noodlijdende pers, je weet wel.
En ik dacht dat de krant juist zo goed ging.
Gaat hij ook. Maar die pik ook wel zijn gaantje mee, hoor, Bakkie.
Maar moet hij zijn boeken daar dan niet over open doen?
In Den Haag? Sjofle Bakkie? Met dat zorgenkopje? Nee, niet hoor. Die hoeft in Den Haag zijn hoed maar af te nemen of ze staan hem op vol te scheppen. En dan mompelt hij nog iets van, ga niet best. Kijk maar in mijn boeken. Zeggen die ambtenaren, nee, laat maar, we zien het ook zo wel. En ik krijg nog een sigaar achter zo hard toe.
Ja, het gaat om de diversiteit van de opinierende persmedia, chef.
Jazeker, Paul. Al erg genoeg dat we de trekschuit destijds zo lelijk hebben laten verkommeren, man. Want daar had ik nou graag eens het Rijksmammoedok voor gebouwd.
Zeg, maar waar moest jij je nou voor laten ontvoeren?
Om die man aan nieuws te helpen. Rebellen ontvoeren bekend zakenman. Het is me nogal geen primeur te zeggen. En hij heeft meteen zijn reden.
Waarvoor?
Om die nieuwbouw aan mij te gunnen. En niet aan de heertjes Bosraaf en Herrenburg. Twee vliegen in één klap. Goed, hè? Is hè? Vies uitgekomen, hè?
Ze vragen onze verbindingsman met de perskoen.
Ja, vertel eens, Paul. Staat het er al in? Met een nieuw bericht door zijn man August Biels ontdoet zich eigenhandig van belagers. Zakenman blijft ongebroken of zoiets. Vertel eens, wat zei die Bruin, Bakkie Bruin?
Ik weet niet, chef.
Ik weet niet.
Nou, kijk, dat niet zo lekker, chef. Weet je wel, dat vrong een beetje.
Vrong? Wat valt daar nou aan te vroegen?
Nou, ik vroeg hem dus of hij interesse had voor dat berichtje, chef.
Berichtje?
Ja, en toen keek hij meteen al een beetje zuinig, hè.
Oh ja? Keek hij zuinig? Maar dan kijkt hij altijd, Bakkie.
Ja, nee, maar hij zegt, joh, Koen, riekt dat niet een beetje naar sluikreclame, dat?
Sluikreclame?
Ja, kijk, hij zegt, chef, Bakkie zegt, joh, Koen, moet je horen, het zijn drie grote adverteerders, hè, Biels, Bosraaf en Herrenburg, en als ik er nou één groot op de voorpagina breng, wat zeggen die anderen dan?
Nou ja, zeg allemaal, dan wat moet ik dan doen om groot op de voorpagina te komen?
Ja, dat heb ik hem ook gevraagd, chef.
Oh ja, en wat zei
hij? Hij zegt, joh, Koen, doe me nou een lol en kijk de zaak nou nog even aan, hè, en gaat het nou fout met die man, ja, dan komt het allemaal wat makkelijker te liggen, weet je wel.
Als het bij fout gaat, kan het dan wat makkelijker te liggen.
Zeker niet, chef, dat zegt hij ook. Hij zegt, joh, Koen, niet dat ik graag een adverteerder als meneer Biels kwijtraakt, begrijp me goed, maar Bosraaf en Herrenburg scheelt het een concurrent niet. Dus die zal het een zorg zijn wat ik dan met mijn voorpagina doe, want dat zijn harde jongens, hoor.
Zeg, hoor even, meneer Bakkie Bruin Waspik, al het woord zeg. Die is vanaf nog in staat te gaan afdingen op de losprijs.
Ja, houd daar helemaal over op, zeg.
Over wat?
Over die vraagprijs van jou.
Die wat?
Die vraagprijs.
Sinds wanneer heet iemand zo'n losprijs een vraagprijs?
Nou, daar kom je gauw genoeg achter, oma ouwe, want dat is een bedelpartij geweest, zeg. Weerzinwekkend gewoon.
Proost.
Ja, zeg, wie hebben jullie daar nou eigenlijk voor benaderd, voor het geld?
Hè? De zaak natuurlijk. Wie betaalt iemand voor het geld? De zaak? Wie anders? Nou, daar heb ik wel een paar uur over, hoor, voor zo'n stuntje.
Ja, dus ik bel Sjors, niet?
Sjors?
Ja, Rinderman, mijn compagnon, wie anders? Ik was er niet.
Ja, en ik vraag dus nog iets vragen, Sjors. Op hoeveel schat jij de waarde van oma Aug, Sjors?
Ja, stel je dan even dat dorre koffie erbij voor, zeg, dat keukenbekkie. Goeie vraag trouwens, hè. Bielse vraag je weer. Waar ze niet omheen kunnen, hè. En op hoeveel schat hij me? Dat benieuwt mij nou even, hè. Dan moest hij het toch een keer zeggen, hè. Nou moest hij het toch een keer toegeven, wat zei hij?
Hij zegt, Jos, hij zegt, wat de gekke vergeef heeft.
Wat de gekke vergeef? Wat? Wat gekke vergeef?
Ja, ik zeg, moet je even horen, we hebben die man ontvreemd, Jos, en onze vraagprijs is 2 miljoen, weet je wel?
Ja, dat komt er dichterbij, 2 miljoen, wat zei hij?
Hij zegt, mag het ook 2 miljoen bitter wezen?
Dus meer dan.
Ik zeg, nou ja, je deponeert het een en ander bij de oude eik in het bos van Piet. Of oma oudste stompie kaas wordt uitgeblazen.
Wel ja, waarom ook niet, hè? Voor een tegenwaarde van 2 meloenen pitten kan je een aardig stompie kaas uitblazen, hoor. Kan je vertellen?
Nou begrijp ik het pas, zeg. Dan zat ik bij in het gesprek.
Ja.
Ik zeg nog, Meloenenpitten, waar heb je het nou over? Hij zegt, ah, die gekke oog is weer bezig. Nou, en toen zijn we de hond gaan uitlaten.
Dan zitten wij een kwartier of langer, zitten wij in de struiken bij de oude eik te vernikkelen. En dan eindelijk komt Jos nog eens opdagen.
Aha, zie je wel, eerst de grote mond en dan volgen.
En wat wordt er onder de oude eik gedeponeerd?
Ja. Wat had meneer de moed te deponeren?
Nee, hij niet, die hond van hem.
Ja.